Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail bro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise. Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail bro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation. That's right, we need our own nation. As a matter of fact, we need to take back our planet back. Original melanated people of the earth. I'm talking about black people, the descendants of Africa, the original people of the earth. Brothers and sisters, tonight is a continuation of a five-part series, and this is the first segment of the five-part series. It will be continued in a week from this week as we are broadcasting a replay of the grand jury, the Court of People's Opinion, which is a preliminary to a human rights tribunal that has been convened by several attorneys, doctors, scientists, and researchers from all over the planet, from the different countries, America, the UK, France, Germany, South Africa, India, Czech Republic, several different, so far there's been folks from different pockets of the planet who have been participating in this human rights, this grand jury that will be leading up to a full-fledged human rights tribunal charging crimes against humanity for those individuals, corporations, and governments that have been responsible for this plandemic with the SARS-2 coronavirus plandemic, which has included the unleashing of a not natural but a man-made virus on the planet. So this testimonies that we are playing tonight were part of a three-day first portion of this human rights tribunal. It's been set up in the grand jury style, and they have been explaining a lot of the historical backdrop of these individuals and the overall scheme that led to this pandemic. Not only that, they have been uncovering the whole wicked game plan and how fear propaganda was pushed, how actual murderous medical protocols were put into place, and fraud of all kind of levels, you name it, has been put into place to cause such horrific deaths, such horrific poisonings of the people, contamination, you name it. So we began playing part one of this five-part series on last night. Today is part two. And again, we'll have these testimonies playing out for the next few days. Then we'll come back on Wednesday and hear a live report from the Your Immunity Project. Why are we so adamant on this with the New Black Panther Party? Let's not forget, we are the New Black Panther Party for self-defense. There is a grand assault that is taking place that has not only affected the black community, but has affected the whole entire earth. And in particular, those corporates that are in position, one of the key things these corporates, these wicked devils, and their accomplices are doing is trying to exterminate two-thirds of the planet Earth. Well, we know for a fact that African people, melanated people across the diaspora are the majority of it. So that two-thirds that is truly being targeted is us people. So I'm going to play this clip. I hope you're taking notes. Please share this episode. If you're listening online, share it. If you missed any parts of last night, just like any program that we've aired for the last 13 years, you could go back to blogtalkradio.com/the New Black Panther Party and pull the segments up on demand. Here we go. Part two, Black Power.
Matthew Arrett's testimony.
Thank you. I have to say that presentation was more than I expected, though, and that I think sets the tone very well for the torch that I'm being handed right now. I would just maybe push back on one single point, which is that no matter what the oligarchy might wish legally or formally be the claim of who owns the soul or the body and freedom of people, it has no bearing in reality. There is a natural law that is higher than the law that they wish to impose onto the universe, and that's part of the problem with ivory tower thinkers, right? They always want the universe to conform to their mathematical models. And they kind of go into conniption fits of rage when they discover that the universe is much more creative and nonlinear than they want it to be. So it's a sort of God complex, which is ultimately the downfall, I think, of empires historically. Every time you see the oligarchy sort of self-cannibalize and melt down under its own self-contradictions, it's a natural thing that should happen the way it does. The question is, are we willing to tolerate that level of folly and immorality to the point that we go down with it, right? And that's always the challenge for every generation. This isn't a new thing. And obviously, we are at the end of a system. I'm going to do something a little bit different. I will deal, well, originally I was going to talk a lot more about eugenics. Now, I understand that in February 26th, we're going to focus a lot more on eugenics, so I won't do that. I will carry on the theme that Alex raised, but I will do this by first dealing with about 8 minutes of the present situation, just to get across what is the British hand in global affairs today in a little bit more detail, using a little one-minute video from Justin Trudeau here in Canada, where we have this shadow of a shadow who's been, imposed onto the people to carry out a policy that really doesn't come from him. And I think everybody recognizes that there's nothing really there. He's kind of like a young version of Biden. His whole life has sort of been handled. But the question being, well, obviously, if this guy is too much of a Ken doll without a brain or a soul to actually carry out or make decisions, then what is the power behind the so-called throne? So I'm going to start with a video. Then I'm going to go back after dealing with the present a little bit more into the 19th century a little bit with a Canadian focus, just because this is something on people's perspective right now, being being what is happening is currently happening in Ottawa. And then we're going to carry up to the battles in the post-World War II age, just to see how this thing transmogrified and recalibrated after World War II. So we'll just do this in a summary way. I'll try not to oversimplify too much, but obviously this is a complex issue, and I will try to do justice and rigor to what needs to be understood. So the first thing is the video that I promised, which I'm going to play here. It's about a minute and a half. Share sound. All right. I hope people can hear this. This is not the video. I'm so sorry. Let's try that again. Share sound. Share. Okay. Can people see the Canadian press?
Yes, we can see it.
All right.
I, Justin P.J. Trudeau, do swear that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, Queen of Canada, her heirs and successors. So help me God. I, Justin P.J. Trudeau, do solemnly and sincerely swear that I shall be a true and faithful servant to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II as a member of Her Majesty's Privy Council for Canada. I will, in all things to be treated, debated, and resolved in Privy Council, faithfully, honestly, and truly declare my mind and my opinion. I shall keep secret all matters committed and revealed to me in this capacity, or that shall be secretly treated of in council. Generally, in all things, I shall do as a faithful and true servant ought to do for Her Majesty, so help me God. I, Justin P.J. Trudeau, do solemnly and sincerely promise and swear that I will truly and faithfully, and to the best of my skill and knowledge, execute the powers and trusts reposed in me as Prime Minister, so help me God.
Okay. No one can hear anything anymore, right?
No. The video is over, but we can hear you.
Great. Okay. Yeah. So that is a little bit of a confusing thing for some people who saw this in 2017. Not your typical thing you would expect a so-called Democratic head of state to be doing when he is declaring his oath of office after an election. But then again, Trudeau is not really the head of state. As we've come to see, he's both a member of the Privy Council office, which you have to be if you're going to be in a cabinet position in government or in the opposition. The actual head of state is the governor general, that older gentleman standing next to him, who is the appointee carrying out the emanation of the powers and authority of the crown to give royal assent to any law that becomes law in Canada. You have lieutenant governors, a position in every single province. You have a privy council office. You have this whole weird Byzantine structure above the apparent public aspect of our so-called democracy and this monarchy of the north. Which is, again, very confusing for a lot of people. We're going to go into a little bit more of what this is. What is this anomalous thing, and what is it a part of internationally? How did it come into being? So here I've prepared a series of slides. Just to get across, that Canada is, after all, a part of the Commonwealth, the British Commonwealth. This is something that was set up in the late 1930s in preparation for well, essentially the transformation of the British Empire's outward image. Today, there's about 54 countries in the British Commonwealth, with the center being the United Kingdom. The head of it is the Queen of England. You have this thing occupying about 12.2 million square miles of territory. 2.4 billion people are represented within territories here, 21% of the world's land area. And, you know, people celebrate this thing as if it's somehow a democratic institution, and it's a bit weird. Like, what is this thing that also, if you look at a lot of these territories, a lot of it is the Caribbean, the Latin American areas aren't so touched, but a lot of the Caribbean is. A lot of Africa, there's 19 African nations in sub-Saharan African Africa. There are 8 Asian nations, India being the biggest, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, obviously, the Five Eyes minus the United States. But let's just compare this to the old British Empire. This is a screenshot from a 1920 map. It looks pretty similar, doesn't it? So people say, oh, the British Empire just, it disappeared after World War II. It let its territories go free. And now the empire is the big bad American empire. That's the mythology that's been passed down to us. And it is a mythology. As Alex went through very concisely, the real power, the that controls the fifth column inside of the United States, which has always been there since 1776, has always been centered in London. We're going to flesh this out a little bit more, but it never disappeared. No empire of this sort ever just willfully gives liberty. Liberty is something you fight for. Just quickly, the issue of current mining interests today. I mean, this is not something that just occurred in the 1880s, 1890s with the land grab for Africa and Cecil Rhodes's creation of De Beers and Lonerhoe and other mining interests. This is a 2016 report. It's a fantastic report by a nonprofit that conducted audits on the British interests, those interests that are controlling mining in Africa, with headquarters in either the UK or within Commonwealth territories, measured on the London Stock Exchange. And just a small quote here, it's a new colonialism, Britain's scramble for African energy and mining resources. It says 101 companies listed on the London Stock Exchange, most of them British, have mining operations in 37 sub-Saharan African countries. They collectively control over $1 trillion worth of Africa's most valuable resources. The UK government has used its power and influence to ensure that mining companies, British mining companies, have access to Africa's raw materials. This was the case during the colonial period, and it is still the case today. This report is available for free online as a PDF. I'm not going to go into details. It is upwards of 70% of the mining interests, which also include refining materials by companies that are in British-controlled territories. What is the infrastructure carrying this out? There's something that a lot of people don't even know about. This is an organization affiliated with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as well as the World Bank, called Crown Agents. It was set up in 1833 as self-description, as an emanation of the crown. It's not part of the government, but its authority comes from the fount of all honors, the crown itself. That's the way the sort of Byzantine structure is emanated, the shadow government. There's a sort of hierarchy of authority. It doesn't come from the consent of the governed. It comes from the singular sovereign, the crown, whoever that may be, as a hereditary institution. So this was set up in 1833 as a branch of the British Colonial Office to manage the infrastructure, hard and soft, a lot soft, of the colonies internationally of the empire. It did a few name changes over the years, and in 1996, it went through another name change called the Crown Agents for Overseas Government Administration, where it also has been managing the health infrastructure, including COVID protocols of Eastern Europe, especially Ukraine. It manages many African countries, South Sudan, Myanmar, and it deals with governance. It helps these countries adapt their governing mechanisms according to World Bank and IMF standards. It's been there and doing this for a very long time, and it's a very strange thing. And again, they call themselves Crown Agents. It's not me slandering them or calling them. And this has been around, as I said, for a very, very long time. So that's one aspect of this thing in terms of the maintenance of the shadow empire. Now, one thing about this Commonwealth City of London managed system is that the Cayman Islands and offshore banking is the center of this. There was a wonderful documentary that people can watch called The Spider's Web on Britain's Invisible Empire that is available on YouTube even. It goes through this in a nice way, but it just gets across that internationally, you have 24% of the financial services moving through a lot of the of British-controlled Cayman Islands, Caribbean and other offshore tax havens. But also within these is the center of global drug money laundering and terrorist financing. People think, oh, drugs, it's just a natural plague of our society. Terrorism, it's just a natural thing that just happens. And it's like, no, no, this is very artificial. This is not the way human society just comes up with these plagues of sociology. These were created diseases that are geopolitical in nature, not even religious in nature, that are cultivated from the top. This is a 2012 Senate report conducted over a long period by the recently deceased Senator Carl Levin on U.S. vulnerabilities to money laundering, drugs, and terrorist financing, the HSBC case, whereby in the course of this, it was discovered that HSBC was the primary number one offshore account money laundering bank in the world. As Alex pointed out, they were set up in 1865 in order to enforce or manage the opium trade to destroy China. That never stopped. They were found guilty. They were slapped on the wrist with a certain fine of $1.9 billion. They were allowed to appoint their own auditor to sit there for 5 years. And as far as I can see, they're still doing what they do. They have a huge stake in Air Canada as well. Anybody who takes a plane to Canada will see HSBC signs everywhere. That is a huge piece of infrastructure as part of the Silver Triangle that's been underway for the whole of the 20th century. You have there a picture of the Queen with Banque Cruz. That's the Queen's personal bank, which was also 2012 found guilty for drug money laundering. It paid its own little, I think maybe $10 million fine, and the bad publicity resulted in the Banque Cruz's offshore accounts that were conducting the laundering to be sold off to the Royal Bank of Canada, which currently conducts the same operations. So that's that. Africa as well has $177 billion of debt holding it hostage. Meanwhile, about $944 billion of revenue from the extraction of wealth sits in British offshore accounts. So it is not a debtor, but a predator nation en masse. This is a whole story unto itself. The City of London, as Alex pointed out, it's a separate entity. Even the UK government can't really do much legally to stop it. They have their own courts, their own police. It's a weird structure. Okay, I just want to throw that out. And I didn't even talk about the Iraq war, dodgy dossiers being justified and created by British intelligence that justified the bombing of Iraq, Libya as well. That was more MI6 intelligence. I didn't talk about that. I didn't talk about the Syrian dodgy dossiers of chemical weapons that were never actually proven to be used by Assad, but that have been justified for sanctions and justifying the regime change that has been attempted now for 7 years. I didn't talk about that. But all that to say, it's everywhere. The British hand, everywhere you scratch a little bit, even in the course of the dodgy dossiers to try to put Putin as the big bad guy controlling Trump, those dodgy dossiers were brought to us by people like Sir Richard Dearlove, the guy who brought us the original Iraq War yellow cake dodgy dossier. That was always a fraud, and the Chilcot Commission report proved that to be the case. And also the question of Rhodes Scholars, people like Strobe Talbot, who is a Rhodes Scholar, came in with Clinton and has been there running Brookings for a very long time. This is also, he's been behind Russiagate with many other Rhodes Scholars currently managing the Biden administration, like Jake Sullivan, Susan Rice, Eric Lander, the science czar, Rhodes Scholars. So, I mean, they're just everywhere, and I won't go into that. Some historical context. I'm Canadian. So the question of Justin Trudeau, I hope that's still an imprint in people's mind is, what the hell is that? So the Privy Council Office, unlike the United States Constitution or Declaration, Canada was founded in 1867. The original conference with our founding fathers was not something that was a part of a fight for freedom, unlike the U.S. This was something where these were all British loyalists, anti-Republican. They were all like our founding father who's standing up there in the painting, Johnny MacDonald, was an Aryan, complete race patriot wanting an Aryan Canada. And who said, a Britisher I was born and a Britisher I will die. He was a filthy, filthy, immoral scumbag. And these are the people celebrated as our sacred cows that we're supposed to honor in Canada. Now, unlike the U.S., which enshrines the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in the Declaration of Independence, as well as the idea of the principle of the general welfare, both now and into posterity in the Constitution, the Canadian founding document says literally, whereas the provinces of Canada, at the time there were four of them, have expressed their desire to be federally united in one dominion under the crown of the United Kingdom and of Great Britain and Ireland, with a constitution similar in principle to that of the United Kingdom, which is itself a bit of a fraud since the UK doesn't really have a constitution. So it's sort of a mirroring of a shadow. And whereas such a union would conduce to the welfare of the provinces and promote the interests of the British Empire. So that's our so-called preamble, is to promote the interests of the British Empire. That's why we were created. We were also created, this conference that drafted that was, it occurred 3 years earlier in 1864, while the Civil War was just winding down. It was still being fought. The British had put a lot of resources into breaking up the Union, as I've gone through in previous presentations. A lot of this is in my books as well, on the clash of the two Americas and the untold history of Canada. The point that the British were afraid of, as I demonstrate, was that Canada had pro-Lincoln statesmen in positions of leadership who were fighting to create an independent country at that time. There were also people who were working to create an American Zollverein, with the Canada and the United States together in one customs union based upon industrial development, with the type of policy, not like America today, but it was a different policy of the Lincoln-McKinley orientation of a real long-term thinking where human beings were seen as a creature that money had to serve by virtue of investing into large-scale infrastructure, science and technology, but also working abroad with Germany, doing the same thing under Otto von Bismarck, with Russia. That had just sold the Alaska territory to the United States with the intent of building rail to the continent into Eurasia. So this was seen as being a vital territory that had to be kept under the control of the British Foreign Office. And so this constitution was drafted. Lincoln's allies were ousted from power. And it was kept as a wedge between the danger of a U.S.-Russia collaboration. Except one Lincoln admirer did become prime minister at a certain point, Wilfrid Laurier, and he did, by 1911, organize to create a customs union, finally. All the bills had been passed, and it was about to go into law, finally. And unfortunately, he was ousted in a coup d'etat that was orchestrated by the Round Table and some Orangemen Freemasons that have the queen, the crown, the head of these different Freemasonic outfits. A paper was written that I've published on the Canadian Patriot site going through those details, but just 2 years later, Wilfrid Laurier writes to his close ally, O.D. Skelton, that Canada is now governed by a junta sitting in London known as the Round Table, with ramifications in Toronto and Winnipeg and Victoria, with Tories, that's conservatives, and Grits, that's liberals, receiving their ideas from London and insidiously forcing them on their respective parties. So that was an admission directly from the man himself, he had a vision for turning Canada into a Lincoln-modeled nation. With a population of 60 million within a generation based upon large-scale electrification and industrialization. That was all ousted, ended. And again, the Round Table took control. Robert Borden, who was his replacement, was a Round Tabler who ended up controlling the Chatham House of Canada at its inception as its first president. By 1918, the Round Table had already initiated a takeover of the British government. They had ousted Herbert Asquith in the Labour government in 1916. Not that he was such a great guy, but they really wanted to have their full controls on the terms of the Versailles Treaty and the end of World War I. One of the problems, they needed the United States. They really needed the power of the United States behind them, and that's been always the objective of the Cecil Rhodes design. Lord Lochiel, who was a leading roundtabler at the time, he was the ambassador to the United States, had written, his other name was Philip Kerr. They always have names that sound kind of like Star Wars villains. He wrote, the problem of the American psyche that had to be dealt with is that there is a fundamentally different concept in regards to the question between Great Britain and the United States as to the necessity of civilized control over politically backward peoples. The inhabitants of Africa and parts of Asia have proved unable to govern themselves. Yet America not only has no conception of this aspect of the problem, but has been led to believe that the assumptions of this kind of responsibility is iniquitous imperialism. So it's a problem, right? The Americans have this damn, they don't get that there's a white man's burden. that they have to impose, you know, because they're just scientifically better than the darker skinned people. They have to morally and scientifically impose an Anglo-American control over the backward peoples, and they don't get it. And that was a problem. Not there were Americans that did get it, and that was, again, part of the American deep state problem that I had mentioned that Alex went through a bit. But what had happened? So there were several attempts at new world orders. Okay, what we're seeing today is not a new thing. I alluded to this in previous presentations, but in 1919, you had the creation of Chatham House, you had the creation of the Versailles Treaty, the League of Nations, all orchestrated by Lord Milner, who at this time was a leading figure controlling British foreign policy, along with many other roundtablers. The idea of the League of Nations was to create a collective security pact, Article 10, get rid of national sovereignty over economics and military affairs, and create effectively a one-world government. Part of this was also part of the Imperial Federation, kind of like what the European Union is what they wanted for all of their, you know, basically the world. That failed. Why did it fail? Because people, both in Canada, the Laurier liberals had made a comeback through the 1920s, and they resisted it. Irish Free State movements resisted it. People like Warren Harding, who was assassinated. I say assassinated. I've never seen evidence to the contrary. The American president, from eating poisoned oysters, died. But point being is you had nationalists that resisted and didn't succumb to this pressure at the time. So it petered out, and they tried again. 1933, there was the International Bankers Conference in London, centered around the Bank of International Settlements, the Bank of England, and 66 nations had been a part of it, all with the design that the Great Depression would be solved by moving sovereignty economically from nation states into officially a central banker's coterie under the Bank of England. And the only reason after 6 months that failed is that Franklin Roosevelt pulled the U.S. delegations out of all participation, and the thing just fell apart. I wrote about that in Chapter 7 of my Clash of the Two Americas in detail. Then there was another attempt in 1944. Again, Roosevelt had not yet died. John Maynard Keynes was assigned this time to represent the British Empire at the Bretton Woods Conference with the idea of a one-world currency run by the Bank of England called the Bancor, an international exchange rate that would be, again, effectively a one-world currency, with the idea of the Americans who had come out of World War II as the only unbroken country to be the battering ram or the enforcers of an Anglo-American reconquering of the nations of the world, many of whom had fought during the war and many had ideas of independence and freedom alive in their hearts. That was not acceptable. I just have a little quote by Franklin Roosevelt, which I really like, where he made the point that they who seek to establish systems of government based on the regimentation of all human beings by a handful of individual rulers call this a new order. It is not new, and it is not order. That was a sharp quote. So to pick up here a little bit now where Alex has left off, there's a book called As He Saw It, written in 1946 by Roosevelt's son and his assistant, his personal assistant, Elliot Roosevelt. And he documents a lot of the battles between Roosevelt versus the Churchill gang that were trying to always pull the U.S. into a brotherhood of control a la Cecil Rhodes, right, a la Five Eyes, which is already what was creeping up and happening from the Black Chamber being transformed into the NSA in 1930. Which became integrated more and more into this British Five Eyes thing, which was, again, always the Cecil Rhodes will orientation. But in this book, it's a great book. People can find this online. They could buy it. They should buy it. It's on archive.org. I use it extensively. But he talks in 1944 after a battle with Churchill, I think at the Tehran conference. I'm not too sure which conference. But he speaks to Elliot, saying, you know, any number of times the men in the State Department have tried to conceal messages to me, delay them, hold them up somehow, just because some of those career diplomats over there are not in accord with what they know I think. They should be working for Winston. And as a matter of fact, a lot of the time they are working for Churchill. Stop to think of them. Any number of them are convinced that the way for America to conduct its foreign policy is to find out what the British are doing and then to copy that. I was told 6 years ago to clean out the State Department. It's like the British Foreign Office. So the OSS had not been cleaned out, and the OSS had a lot of problems, but there were still a lot of patriots and nationalists embedded in American intelligence within the OSS that were problematic for those trying to take control, who had pretty much occupied most of the State Department by this time. Within Elliot's book, there's another wonderful battle between him and Churchill that was documented over what would be the post-war era, what type of operating principles would govern it. were FDR's vision for the greening of African deserts, the extension of the Tennessee Valley Authority, the rural electrification projects that pull people out of poverty and backwardness inside of the USA, that would be extended through large-scale loans internationally to help other countries have their own industrial programs, their own Tennessee Valley authorities, and really to extend the principle of the four freedoms to the world, that were not just about, supposed to be just, you know, nice, flaky words, but real active, like active, which is why Bretton Woods, the Keynesian team lost out, and Harry Dexter White, who became the first director of the IMF, also dying under mysterious circumstances. The American delegation under him had won out and made sure that even China, India, Africa, South America, Russia would all be participants in receiving Tennessee Valley Authority projects that were all approved by the U.S. delegation. They were all resisted by the British delegation. And even at that time, when Roosevelt had a Russia-China-U.S. alliance as his bedrock, Russia was a subscriber for $1 billion into the IMF originally, before the Iron Curtain caused them to be forced out. All that to say, I ramble, but in this small extract I selected, he's describing now the evening, talking with Eliot after the fighting with Churchill, saying, "I'm talking about another war." He's warning about World War III. "I'm talking about what will happen to our world if, after this war, we allow millions of people to slide back into the same semi-slavery. Don't think for a moment, Eliot, that Americans would be dying in the Pacific tonight if it hadn't been for the short-sighted greed of the French and the British and the Dutch." That's the colonialists. "Shall we allow them to do it all over again? Your son will be about the right age, 15 or 20 years from now." One sentence, Eliot, then I'm going to kick you out of here. I'm tired. It's this sentence. "When we've won the war, I will work with all my might and main to see to it that the United States is not wheedled into the position of accepting any plan that will further France's imperialistic ambitions or that will aid or abet the British Empire in its imperial ambitions." So tragedy strikes, right? It's a long story, but Wallace is replaced by Harry Truman, who's a George Bush sort of prototype, banker's boy, Anglophile, and he's brought in now as the new vice president. So Wallace was the vice president who was completely on line with FDR's vision. Roosevelt dies April 12th, no autopsy is ever done. And immediately, within the preceding months, nuclear bombs are dropped on a defeated Japan by Truman. September 20th, the OSS, the American Intelligence Agency, is disbanded, and a massive purge begins of anybody who had an understanding of the Wall Street London financiers behind fascism's rise and eugenics rise. There was a lot. There were reports on this. These were all purged in the ensuing year. And at this point, the Iron Curtain speech is launched, and people think, oh, yeah, that was the Americans who did the Iron Curtain, which turned Russia and China into their enemies. No, it was Winston Churchill who came to the United States, stayed at the White House for a sustained period, and delivered his speech where he said, "Neither the sure prevention of war nor the continuous rise of world organization will be gained without what I have called the fraternal association of the English-speaking peoples. This means a special relationship between the British Commonwealth and Empire and the United States." Henry Wallace, just before he gets fired, he's now Commerce Secretary, fighting against this insanity that was brainwashing the American people into these, you know, paranoid mobs, afraid of commie infiltration and conspiracy. I mean, yeah, the whole McCarthyism thing was a real atrocity run by the FBI as a dictatorship, which it was. The U.S. became a dictatorship under the FBI. He says fascism, he warns, in the post-war inevitably will push steadily for Anglo-Saxon imperialism and eventually for war with Russia. Already American fascists are talking and writing about this conflict and using it as an excuse for their internal hatreds and intolerances towards certain races, creeds, and classes. Obviously here there's a complete racist backlash again, sponsored by J. Edgar Hoover, another 33rd degree Freemason, running the FBI for like seven American presidencies, that's supporting the rise of racism, the dismantling of civil liberties for African Americans and others, but also coordinating with the CIA that is soon reconstituted to create a new management system, much more in alignment with British foreign policy. Things like MK Ultra that was originally using science crafted by Tavistock, the British intelligence branch of psychological warfare. COINTELPRO infiltration that also mirrored Operation Gladio in Europe. These were all things deployed, justified by the terms and conditions of the Age of Mutual Assured Destruction. So it continues. Wallace is now fired after giving this speech. The Truman Doctrine is announced. Again, who is the main organizer of the Truman Doctrine? One of the key guys is George McGee, a Rhodes Scholar. You have the Central CIA is created in September 18th now, completely, so a new reconstituted, cleansed intelligence agency. Harry Dexter White dies. IMF is hijacked. That was the guy who was on Roosevelt's team, who is now at that point in 1948. He was fighting to get Wallace elected under the Progressive Party leadership in the 48 elections. You'll find many great patriots of the United States either died or had their careers annihilated who were part of this network. and then you have this famous July 50th NSC, National Security Council 75 memorandum to save the British Empire. I kid you not, this is literally a protocol issued to under the logic that if the British weakens its imperial economic interests, then the Soviets will take and fill that space. So the U.S. foreign policy interest has to be to preserve British interests abroad. And this is where the IMF, the World Bank, increasingly became rewired to use economic colonialism wherever needed if you can't stop the political independence of a nation, at the very least sabotage their economic independence. One guy who's an interesting figure is Clement Attlee at this time, who's post-World War II prime minister. And he makes a strong point that over and over again, we have seen that there is another power which has its seat at Westminster. The City of London, a convenient term for a collection of financial interests, is able to assert itself against the government of the country. Those who control money can pursue a policy at home and abroad, contrary to that which is being decided by the people. So again, you have even British, so it's not the British government, right? The British people are also as much victimized by, as well as many figures within the British government are victimized by this power above the official visible branches of government. Throughout the Cold War, again, if you can't understand the architecture of the Cold War, of mutually assured destruction, the asymmetrical warfare, game theory doctrines, the application of systems analysis to manage the geopolitical overthrows of governments, things like the Vietnam War, if you don't look at people like Dean Rusk, Rhodes Scholar, Walt Whitman Rostow, who ran the NSA for 3 years, who was a Balliol Rhodes Scholar, S. Scott Reed, who was the architect of NATO, to break Russia out of any influence in the Security Council over military affairs. NATO, that was Escott Reed, Rhodes Scholar. William Fulbright, Rhodes Scholar. I mean, there's so many that overlap. You can't really understand what is this thing that JFK was pushing back against and trying to fight against. What was the thing that Eisenhower was warning about in his military-industrial complex speech? You can't understand that if you don't look at these ideologues who have been penetrated over decades. There's been 3,000 so far in the 20th century who've been processed through the halls of Oxford. Not that they're all bad. I think Chris Christopherson is an okay actor, and maybe his movie choices are not so great sometimes. But I don't think he's a bad guy, though he was a Rhodes Scholar. So you'll find that you can't be guilty by association, but you can't understand anything unless you understand this very controlled, centralized hive that also coordinates with the American Roundtable Movement, which is the Council on Foreign Relations, the thing that Hillary Clinton referred to as the mothership in a 2011 speech. That has always been, since 1921, the British Roundtable in America. And even people who you think of as being American geopolitical grand designers, like Kissinger, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Samuel P. Huntington, Clash of Civilizations, a Canadian, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who did his own martial law in 1970, and really reorganized the entire government as a technocratic cybernetic system. They were all processed under William Yandel Elliott in Harvard, who ran something that some have referred to as the Chatham House of Harvard. William Yandel Elliott was one of these guys who just liked having talented young sociopathic boys brought around him, and he just trained generations of these geopoliticians who were processed. It's like a talent searching thing, as Rhodes describes. It's exactly what they carried out. And then brought back into positions of ideological authority to carry out a policy that they themselves were not the originators of per se, but they were put into positions to make it happen. We did have pushback, and I just want to have some counter voice, because it's not like they're godlike creatures, right? There was real human beings, real statesmen, especially throughout the 1960s. You have Enrico Mattei, the Italian industrialist. You have Dag Hammarskjöld, the Secretary General of the UN, who had a grand program to end imperialism and promote industrial development in a variety of countries, especially in South Africa. Charles de Gaulle had avoided 30 assassination attempts. John F. Kennedy, obviously. You have Patrice Lumumba. I didn't put everybody on here who was either assassinated or overthrown in CIA MI6-directed coups, but all that to say, it was a major period of potential where the common theme was cooperation and breaking out of the mathematical ways of governance, right? Introduce new technologies, new discoveries that were not monopolized, and do it through a way of looking for win-win cooperation, points of common interest. That's why JFK offered the Russians the ability to work with the United States on a joint space program together. So that would be something to break away, to liberate us from this mathematical, you know, balance of terror way of governance. I'm ending up now. I think maybe 3-4 more minutes. So after the age of assassinations again in the 60s, very parallel to the thing that was happening after the 1890s to World War I, again, age of total assassinations and color revolutionary coups, you have the stage is set now for a full economic recolonization of the United States. Especially the focus has always been take back control of the United States. You have this with several things happen, and Kissinger is a key figure in much of this. You have the creation in January 1971 of the Inter-Alpha Group, created under the blueprint of Lord Jacob Rothschild, who was running NM Rothschild and Sons, but also has been a major banking and financier interest as a part of a mercenary dynasty since the 1700s. So the Inter-Alpha Group of banks was a coterie of, there's a picture of it there, of the member banks with key major banks set up in each of the focused European countries to advance a new doctrine of deregulation, centralizing power away from nation states, especially in Europe, and moving it into the private supranational coterie of corporate and financial interests above national authorities. I don't have time to go into detail there. That was 1971. That group was founded. It has since grown in number since its original founding six. Many of these banks were all tied to, financial activities supporting fascism's rise, whether Franco, Mussolini, or Hitler earlier on. A lot of that whitewashed. Then you have same month, the World Economic Forum is founded by one of Kissinger's prodigies, who we all know and despise, Klaus Schwab. Also, one of the co-founders was Maurice Strong, a Canadian oligarch who was picked up by the Rockefellers and was a co-founder of the Canadian Club of Rome, major player with Prince Philip, who is the guy who is called for being reincarnated as a deadly virus, who ran the World Economic Forum. In my February 26th presentation, we're going to go into detail it'll get gory. So Maurice Strong, another figure who is a co-founder and inspirer of Klaus Schwab. Then you have the big deal here, which is the August 15th, 1971, U.S. dollar is floated. Kissinger and Schultz, running the Nixon administration, orchestrate the removal of the dollar from the gold reserve, the gold exchange system, or the fixed exchange rate system that was preventing speculation on currencies and commodities. As long as you didn't have speculation, it was difficult to conduct the sorts of economic warfare against nations trying to develop their infrastructure and their industrial base, which has always been, even going back to the 19th century, a tool used by empire to keep nations destabilized, this economic warfare. So the fixed exchange rate had to go. It guaranteed too much stability. You were able to think long-term. 5, 20-year projects could be conceptualized when you had relative stability of currencies. And that was floated onto the floating markets. So all of a sudden, the markets became the determinant of the value of the dollar that became increasingly embedded, again, under Kissinger's lead, to the price of oil on the spot markets. So all of a sudden, this created a degree of chaos. So you could no longer really build or maintain or improve your infrastructure, your capital-intensive part of your economy that you need to always have as the basis of your economic value in the system. That became atrophied, and increasingly the age of deregulation, speculation was upon us. I mentioned here for good measure the Trilateral Commission founded in 1973 under Brzezinski, Kissinger, and David Rockefeller. Again, the hand of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is, again, the roundtable movement, is always there, as well as the Bilderberger Group, which is always there. Many of these figures are overlapping with this other thing that I'm going to talk about on February 26th in more detail.
So this is what takes over under Carter, the Trilateral Commission. Nearly every member of Carter's cabinet is a member of the Trilateral Commission. People like Paul Volcker, who becomes the Fed chair, calls for a controlled disintegration of the U.S. economy in 1979, which is where the interest rates are raised to 20% or more for 2 years, destroying small and medium businesses and only leaving these multi-behemoth multinational companies able to survive and thrive and gobble up under mergers and acquisitions. Henry Kissinger delivers at this time a 1981 speech at Chatham House in the UK describing the difference between Churchill and Roosevelt's views of the post-war age and describing – people can read this. It's an appendix in my volume two, the full speech. But he describes how he preferred the Churchill way of thinking about geopolitics over the Roosevelt idea, which he saw as obsolete and incompatible with reality. But in it, he also describes his time as Secretary of State under Nixon, where he says the British were so matter-of-factly helpful that they became a participant in internal American deliberations to a degree probably never practiced between sovereign nations. In my White House incarnation then, I kept the British Foreign Office better informed and more closely engaged than I did the American State Department. It was symptomatic. Total admission. They don't even hide this as saying like, oh, he didn't really say that. No, they just admit it. They just assume that we're too dumb to put words and actions together. Lord Jacob Rothschild in 1983 delivered a speech saying that two broad types of giant institutions, the Worldwide Financial Services Company and the International Commercial Bank with a global trading competence, may converge to form the ultimate all-powerful, many-headed financial conglomerate. What he's referring to is the breakdown of the division of bank activities from commercial, investment, trust, insurance. All of these had formerly, under Roosevelt originally, been designed in separate compartments, so you couldn't speculate with people's savings. You couldn't legally do that. He was talking about taking that away so that you can create a new type of universal banking that does everything, what today we might call too big to fail. This was done originally in Britain under Margaret Thatcher's Big Bang, where the first wave of universal banking was created and London again sort of restored even more of its control than it had formerly enjoyed. You have a near total collapse of a speculative bubble that results in 25% collapse of the stock exchange in New York. As a response to avoiding the collapse, Alan Greenspan is brought in and immediately normalizes creative financial instruments, otherwise known as derivatives, that had formerly been illegal for the most part. These were known as like junk bonds, securitized debts and that were worthless, but that were still securitized and then gambled upon with insurance that became also securitized so that people could, it's complex, but it's insane. It's not a way that you make any value. And it became kind of like a cancerous tumor that grew up in the economy to the point that by 1992, when the Maastricht Treaty was effected, creating the European Union as a new consolidation to get rid of nation states and get rid of the right of nations to emit their own and control their own credit in Europe, there was about $2 trillion of derivatives. That same year, you have the Soviet Union dissolving. The end of history is being celebrated. George Bush says in 1990, at the opening of the Kuwait War, that we have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order where we are successful and we will be. We have a real chance at this new world order. So this is a point where Margaret Thatcher is bragging that she put the steel into the spine of Bush, who was wavering on the issue of Desert Storm. But again, the idea was always it's the end of the nation state system now. Finally, at the end of the Cold War, it's a unipolar era of what today might be called the neoliberal world order. Soviet Union is totally privatized, destroyed, targeted for destruction, overseen by Strobe Talbot, who is the point man on the ground, Rhodes Scholar, working closely with the IMF. NAFTA is signed to, again, get rid of more powers of nation states in North America and move powers into the hands of private corporations above nations. World Trade Organization, and then big time Glass-Steagall, the separation of U.S. banking commercial from speculation is broken down by Clinton, Rhodes Scholar, last act in office. And then from that point forward, you have the ushering in of just the biggest cancer of derivatives, going from $2 trillion in 1992 to $70 trillion in 1999, by that point overlapping the U.S. global GDP, to the point that only 10 years later, you have the deregulation completely of over-the-counter derivatives because Glass Steele is now gone. Too big to fail has become bigger than God, or so they want us to believe. So we have to bail them out. It's like a gun to the head if they go bankrupt. And by 2007, when the next collapse hits, there's $708 trillion of derivatives weighing down the system, far outweighing the $15 trillion of the U.S. GDP. Strobe Talbot in 1992 made his manifesto saying all countries are basically social arrangements, no matter how permanent or even sacred they may seem at any one time. In fact, they are all artificial and temporary. Perhaps national sovereignty was not such a great idea after all. But it has taken the events in our own wondrous and terrible century to clinch the case for world government. That's from his Birth of a Global Nation. Just two last slides here, I'm done. Just to get clear, the takeover of financial services over and the collapse of the real economy, the real part that has value, that sustains life, that has been the trend. You have the crossover of the what you have there is the real estate, rental, leasing, finance, speculation overlapping in 1987 with the physical manufacturing base. That's just one of many graphs put forward. And this is a real economy only works if you have the financial side always servicing and improving upon the real side, manufacturing, infrastructure, science. If the financial side is not servicing that, it's a fake, it's a bubble, and the bubble will pop. And that's why the bubble that was created today, which is popping, was a planned disintegration. It was always designed from 1971 to disintegrate. The question is, when would be the pinprick? The pinprick has happened. Point is, why is there an encirclement of China, of Russia, by the U.S. military, by the British? Why are there all these psyops? Why are there are so many different types of CIA-connected operations to destroy and destabilize Eurasia right now? And I mean, I've talked about this in my last presentation, and this is well documented. What's going on? What are they afraid of? I'm going to end with this last quote by Putin. People might feel feelings of rage when they see Putin's face because they've been fed a lot of propaganda in the media. I don't care. But in a recent speech, Putin just said, only sovereign states can effectively respond to the challenges of the times and the demands of the citizens. Accordingly, any effective international order should take into account the interests and the capabilities of the state and proceed on that basis and not try to prove that they should not exist. Furthermore, it is impossible to impose anything on anyone, be it the principles underlying the sociopolitical structure or values that someone, for their own reasons, has called universal. After all, it is clear that when a real crisis strikes, there is only one universal value left, and that is human life, which each state decides for itself how to best protect based on its abilities, culture, and traditions. I went over my time. I'm really, really sorry I did that, but I really wanted to just drive home a few key lessons of world history. And if there's any questions, if there's time for that, I'll happily answer.
Thank you, Matthew. Let me just verify that I understand you correctly. The main point is that the British Empire has never ceased to exist. It is still there. Colonialism is still existing, except it's existing under a different name. It has never stopped to try and pull the United States back in, but for some reason, it hasn't really been successful. Is the outcome of this? Is that what we're seeing with the deep state idea? Is the deep state that part in the country that tries to reintroduce the United States into the Anglo-American system and into the city of London, basically?
I have no problem with what you just said. I have no problem with that.
Okay. Now, it has not, as far as I can tell from what you're telling us, it hasn't failed in Canada. Their attempt to keep Canada under control has been very successful. I mean, just from listening to how Justin Trudeau took his oath of office, he swore allegiance to the British Crown, to the Queen of England. Doesn't that bother the Canadians?
For those who know, it's a paradigm shifter. But there's a big cognitive dissonance that's been put there by years and generations of conditioning. I mean, here's the thing. In one of the chapters, I go through the creation of a synthetic nationalism in Canada, arranged by none other than Lord Milner himself, who ran the Rhodes Trust in 1909 and came to Canada with Mackinder, who is at the time, I mean, he's the founder of geopolitics in its modern form. But at the time, he was the head of the Fabian Society's London School of Economics. Now, he quit his job as the head of the London School based upon an offer made by Lord Milner, who is from the Round Table, right, which runs through Oxford. So you have the LSC and Oxford. So he quit his job to come to Canada with Milner to formulate a grand strategy to figure out how the hell do we keep Canada as a wedge between Russia and the U.S. and also with Germany, because at the time Germany was still a fascist state at all. Like, there was still a lot of anti-colonial, anti-fascist impulses in very high positions of power around the Frederick List Society and others. So Milner actually, there's a quote where he says, of the three greatest dangers to the British Empire, the preferred thing is greater cohesion. So the top three scenarios for the future regarding Canada is, number one, greater cohesion and integration into the British Federation. That's probably not going to happen. You still had Wilfrid Laurier, Lincoln admirers, other things, right? So it was not going to happen. He said the greatest danger is greater cooperation with that United States of 1909. That's the greatest threat to the British Empire. The middle ground is the growth of a Canadian nationalism. And he actually says, the Canadians are so wonderfully ignorant to the longer forces of history, and they are even so, they feel that they're superior to the Americans in almost every way. It's bumptious and it's fantastic. Those are his words. It's just fantastic how ignorant they are. And we should go with that angle and really craft a new, nationalism for them. And that is exactly what became the entire trend of the 20th century, leading up to the creation of the artificial Canadian flag with a maple leaf that doesn't mean anything, unlike other countries who have flags that mean something. It's literally just a maple leaf. That's what it means. And people like Vincent Massey, who was his prodigy, became our first Canadian governor general, who ran and managed much of this. These were all eugenicists. They created the Canadian Fabian Society as well, which is a whole story run by five Rhodes Scholars in 1931. but yeah, I mean, Canada has been, there's a lot of cognitive dissonance and, myths that have been created that are sacred cows that our minds are afraid to walk to. But now that we actually see the system demonstrating its true tyrannical hand, which it always has had, right? We just didn't push on it, so we didn't get to feel it. But now, as soon as you demand something human like liberty, you actually see the mask coming off. Now people, I think, are much more receptive to figuring out, well, what the hell is really going on? What is this thing called Canada? And I think that overall, the lessons of great patriots who were ousted in Canadian history. I mean, we had our last national government in 1963 that was ousted in a Rhodes Scholar run coup. 1963, that was our last national government. So, you definitely have a hunger, and I think the more people see and think about what Justin Trudeau just said in 2017 and look at what has happened, it does piece a lot of things together. The thing that is very important is a sense of, well, what should a true sovereign nation be? We know what it isn't now, but what should it actually do? Because we do have some serious objective crises, right? A breakdown of food production, supply chains, infrastructure. How do we actually manage coherently to make sure our children not only don't become slaves under this dystopic system, but that they actually have a life that can thrive, where we can invest in a national bank that serves the interests of the people, with other nations organizing themselves in a common, you know, way. That's a whole discussion that has to really take hold. And I think the current protests in Ottawa are a good spark plug. Like, there's a hunger now like I've never seen for these bigger ideas.
That is Canadian nationalism, rather, asserting itself against the British Crown, in essence, right?
In essence.
Okay.
In essence. And I mean, it's based on something principled. It's not artificial. It's really based on the right to feed our families, to work, to have a life, and, you know, the basic fundamental things. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One final question. The power of the City of London combined with its fifth column, Wall Street, is it really true? Did I understand correctly that all that money, all that power was capable of starting two world wars, World War I and World War II, with these financial behemoths financing both sides.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, I feel like I've taken up too much time, but yeah.
Okay. That's I just wanted to make sure that I didn't misunderstand you. And finally, two world wars. Anyone who can start two world wars probably has no problem, because I wrote this down when you said it, to create diseases like terrorism and drug trade. So that, in essence, is also started or was started by this financial behemoth, City of London plus Wall Street.
Yeah, and I would just add one quick thing on that, which is that the British, I conducted an interview with Alex Craner based on a wonderful trilogy he wrote on the original British design for a New World Order under people like Lord Halifax, the appeasers of Britain that were like people like Neville Chamberlain, who were part of an operation which all the way up until 1939, 1940, still wanted to have an Anglo-American fascist alliance with Hitler, mm-hmm. And Mussolini and others to manage the world as a new world order and be enforcers of a eugenics policy of population control under a scientifically managed society from the top. That was a design all the way up until the ouster of Neville Chamberlain, when Hitler became a Frankenstein monster that was no longer sort of behaving according to its commands and had bigger ambitions to be sort of at the head of the helm instead of a secondary, enforcer for the will of a banking class. And they had to sort of change strategy and abort that plan. There's a whole story there, but yeah, the oligarchy, the lesson I carry out of, and I want everyone to carry out of this, is that the oligarchy, they screw up a lot. They're not as powerful as they want us to believe they are, which is an intimidation of the mind. Every time you look at what they're trying, the thing that they're trying to do today is not new. They've tried many times, mm-hmm. and usually it blows up in their face. Mm-hmm. And this like undermines them too. No, so then they have to reorganize and try something new.
I do understand now, however, that Vera Sharaf, a Holocaust survivor, says that she can't believe that she's fighting the same people, the same structures again that she fought 75 years ago, because it looks as though what happened then is happening again. Matthew, I don't want to keep my esteemed colleagues from asking any questions, so please go ahead with your questions.
Hi, Matthew, thank you so much for your evidence. Matthew, at the onset of the statement, your evidence that you've given, you were talking about natural law. As we all know, the substantive law that we are using in this grand jury is natural law. So I would like to find out from you, based on all the research that you've done, how important is natural law for humanity's survival? And most importantly, how is it related to constitutional law? Thank you.
Dexter, that's an amazing question. That's a very good question. In my understanding, all of world history has been shaped by a battle between either artificial law. I mean, mankind is the only species that we know of that creates and improves upon the laws of the systems that we self-organize around. Other animals are ordained by their genetics, by their environments, and their wiring to be what they are, and that's great. But human beings are uniquely able to craft conceptions and apply those conceptions to manage willfully our own existence. And then, again, identify problems with the so-called invisible metaphysical machine of statecraft and improve upon them. But upon what standard do we improve upon? Upon what standard do we judge our man-made laws to say, okay, this one squares with something that is designed by God, and which ones are out of whack, out of harmony, that we have to correct, that are illegitimate, or as Thomas Aquinas would say, forms of violence. So if a law can actually deprives you of your innate ability to express your life, liberty, happiness, creative powers, if that's what a law is doing, it's not a law. It's a form of violence. It does not have to be respected. And that's what the founding fathers, from if you read the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Paine, they were very sensitive to that fact that there is a higher law. It's not even separate from scientific law. That's why Benjamin Franklin was both a scientist who discovered principles of electricity that he shared. But in his mind, his discoveries of the laws of electricity were not separated from the metaphysical moral laws
that became the foundation of his life's effort to create a republic of self-governance premised on the inalienable rights of the individual and not the hereditary institutions that had governed society for thousands of years. That was the first time it was done. And again, in his world, it was two sides of the same thing. Real science is not mathematical description or trying to impose a formula onto the universe and expect the universe to abide by it. It's about tuning our own creative reason in harmony with that universe that is always going to be more discoverable. And every time we transmit those new eurekas in any domain to our fellow mankind and then apply it to the productive process, the universe responds by giving us greater standards of living, right? We can sustain more people at a higher standard of life than we could have if we didn't have electricity, if we didn't have knowledge of fire, where we were like living kind of like, you know, whatever, cattle in caves. So, but this reciprocal nature of the universe having this quality that mankind is made in the image of that universe under certain conditions, if we abide by those certain principles, as Benjamin Franklin and others understood, we will have greater emancipation. The empire, the oligarchical system of a hereditary elite will lose its places to put its claws, like a parasite that it is, into the host. It won't have much to grab onto, and it will lose its power, and it will self-implode, as I think we're seeing right now.
May I add something very briefly? What we are now seeing in the jurisdictions of the United Kingdom, there's the jurisdiction of England and Wales, jurisdiction of Northern Ireland, jurisdiction of Scotland. The court systems in all of these realms, which are basically common law, are starting to arrogate to themselves at judicial level the power to decide mens rea. They are further ahead than any common law or civil law jurisdiction in our repeated findings now in asserting that even if there is a jury there for show, and they seem to be trying to get rid of them now under the spurious claim that international treaty requirements require them to dwindle the use of juries, even if a jury is there for show, they reserve the right to determine what was in the mind of the perpetrator. And very often now, it's a drafting which comes from the tax-exempt foundations, such as the Carnegie Foundation that I spoke about earlier, via the House of Commons Library, tells the legislators in Britain, which then will lead other countries in the same way, the legislators are told there is an ersatz version of the public good or the public welfare now. It's called collective well-being, collective welfare. That's what the foundations were doing all through the 20th century, creating enemies for that very purpose. And now the courts are saying, if you have offended against society, then there is no redress. You are guilty. And that is the furthest towards getting rid of natural law that I've seen anywhere. It's gone further than any European totalitarian state, any international court. It's now coming through that the British national level, through legislation, ultimately from the think tanks, the abolition of the concept that natural law decides whether you're guilty or not.
Can I ask like your opinion, if because we're seeing this not a 100% lockstep constellation right now, we have this like still very strict regulations in Australia and in Canada and these places, but then sort of you're saying that in England it's basically they're preparing it like from a different angle, so it's seemingly like more relaxed at the moment, but I mean they're preparing to finalize the totalitarian grab from through a different angle, basically.
Yeah, I am absolutely convinced of that, that the United Kingdom is in the lead, the Anglo Commonwealth is second, and the resistance to this will actually be largely in Central European countries because they give more weight to the rule of law and to the institutions of courts than they do to juries, for example. They will show more welcome resistance to this idea. It is definitely Britain or British-based think tanks that are pushing on our legislators more than anywhere else in the world this idea that if someone meets the requirements in a code, they are convinced, they are convicted with no defense possible. So it's this spurious idea behind it of you offended against the interests of the common good. That I'm afraid, and you could, from what Matt said, you understand, I think now in some detail, who is saying that, why that, what they are afraid of. They don't want any threat to their narrative.
Any further questions from Anna or Deepali or Dexter or Virginie? I have one question. Is it possible that not only in Europe but also in the United States there is a movement that, having understood what is going on, is trying to distance themselves? I'm talking about the United States, trying to distance themselves from the Europeans, and in particular from the city of London, because we are simply buried under debt and we carry too much dead weight with us. I'm saying this in layman's terms. What do you think, Alex and Matthew?
For my part, absolutely, and I know the recent testimony I gave to you, I spoke about that there is a large belt of heartland America that has woken up to this and now sees what they regard as an Anglo or an Anglo-European problem steering them, and I think that they are getting heartily sick of it all because of the amount of treason involved. I mean, just as codicil to Matt's testimony about 1971 when the financial coup was pulled off, one of the indications that the Americans were being used as hapless pawns in this is that that very year, Kissinger is said to have said that the military, by which he largely meant the US military, were brute, dumb beasts sent to do others' biddings. And in that same year, being the new Secretary of State under the incoming Nixon administration, he got a Massachusetts-based manufacturer, the only manufacturer in the world that could produce precision ball bearings, Bryant Chucking Grinder, to supply the ball bearings to the Soviet Union to allow them to develop multiple independent re-entry vehicle warheads, which I know that one of our extra testimonials this evening from Jim Bush, he personally was involved in the American side of that. So the amount of treason involved is such that where the United States had even a military or an economic lead, the cabal we're talking about deliberately abolished that. And I get a very strong sense from my extensive U.S. contacts that a large swathe of the Americans do not wish to abolish their Anglo heritage, their common law heritage, but they have completely had it now, with British and European intellectual leadership.
Mm-hmm. Makes perfect sense.
I don't want to speak too much because I know we're going far beyond schedule here. But just to say quickly, there are fifth columns in Russia. In every country has their own fifth columns. They've got their own battles between legitimate forces who represent these cultures versus these other parasitical penetrations. I would say in Eurasia, you actually have had more serious pushback in a serious way, to the point that there is a genuine, I don't think this is a game, I think there is an actual genuine alternative strategy that has been deployed outside of the framework of the cage of NATO that is imploding and it was always designed to implode. And I think you've got forces within the United States, I see it more currently on the state level, that don't want to go down with the sinking ship. There's forces all over Europe. Unfortunately, the federal executive branches of most of the transatlantic governments have been in large measure captured, not entirely always, but in a depressing level. So I'm not an expert in geopolitical planning, and I do hope that the creative forces are able to utilize the self-contradictions and insanity of the empire to their benefit, since, again, this empire is – it can only, once it succeeds, it can only destroy itself as well. And I do see that there are people that want to have a future, that want to survive, and that are organically organizing. And I just think they need to sharpen up their game plan of what they understand the world to be. Because a lot of people still think, especially in America and a lot of the patriots who don't like the Great Reset, they tend to have fallen for certain traps that have given them a narrative that it's the Cold War narrative, that the real enemy behind everything it's not the British Empire. It's not the oligarchy. It's not that. It's the Chinese commies that want to destroy your freedoms. That's who's behind everything. And you know, a lot of people fall into that. And I think that to the degree that they hold on to those Cold War narratives, they're going to self-sabotage their overarching desires to have a successful battle against this oligarchical thing. Yeah, that's what I threw out there.
Thank you, Matthew. Any further questions from Anna or Dexter or Virginie or Deepali?
No further questions from me?
None from me either. Thank you. What a wonderful presentation.
Yes, thank you, Matthew. If there are no further questions, then This concludes your testimony. Matthew, thank you very much. Now we will turn to Brian Garish and Debbie Evans for their presentation to us.
I want to thank you very much for inviting me to do this. You asked for a little bit of an introduction, so I'm going to say that my first career was as a British Royal Navy officer. I was specialized in anti-submarine warfare, so I spent a lot of my time finding, tracking Russian nuclear submarines. That was at the height of the Cold War. And of course, I'm going to say that as time has moved on and as I've got older and wiser, I realized that much of what I believed at that time is incorrect. But just to give part of my experience was very much within the military system during the Cold War time. And when I left the Navy in 1993, I was to discover that all was not as it seemed within society in UK. And as a result of tracking mainly fraud and corruption in my own city and getting in contact with people who were seeing fraud and corruption in other major UK cities, I then started to look at organizations which I could see were controlling events, but those organizations were not well known to the public. And where did that take me? It took me ultimately meeting up with a great group of people. And now we are running the UK column, producing news three times a week. Previously, we produced a written newspaper. But we are constantly analyzing what's happening. So it's on the basis of my previous military experience, my experience in the civilian world, including analysis through the UK column, that I can give my testimony to you this evening. And I'll also add, I'm delighted to be joined by a lady called Debbie Evans, who's been doing some very deep research with us, and I felt it was only appropriate that she should be able to give firsthand some indication of what she's found. Now, I've only got 30 minutes, so I'm going to try and move very quickly. And the first thing I'd like to do is try and bridge the scope of what our initial speakers had to say in their evidence. And I believe an analogy would be they have described the founding, the startup, and the growth of an organization of gangsters. And we've heard about the history, we've learned something of the people, their networks, their mode of operation. We've had some evidence of world events that show us that these groups are operating. But then I'm going to say that if we look back on how gangsters were dealt with and successfully brought down in the past, if we look at Al Capone or other gangsters, probably America's a good place to go for that sort of image. They were brought down by looking at the crimes they carried out and ultimately collecting the real evidence of the crimes, whether those were murders or it was drug running or prostitution. There had to be the real evidence of the crime. There had to be the intent. There had to be the named persons who were involved in those crimes. And it was only when that evidence was brought forward, they could be brought into court and subsequently found guilty, or at least brought before the law, and then ultimately serve their time. So I'm going to say that for our jury, which is a world audience, the first two speakers have done a great job of saying that there is there's a conspiracy, there's a group of gangsters that are operating. They've got huge power and wealth. What are those gangsters trying to do? I think the aim for those gangsters is world dominance. They want to control everything, society, raw materials, methods of production, people, politics, everything must come under their control. And ultimately, we then say, what are their crimes? Well, the crimes I was jotting them down while I was listening to the speakers. We're looking at oppression. We're looking at slavery. We're looking at poverty, hunger. We're looking at human trafficking. And ultimately, we're looking at death. And at that point, I believe that we now have a very important major world event happening, and that is the so-called COVID-19 pandemic, followed by a vaccination program, because in my mind, the overwhelming evidence is showing that these gangsters are killing people. So we are here as a call to law to talk about the crime. What is the crime? In my view, the crime is death. In previous years, we've seen people dying as a result of their created wars. But in more recent times, we're seeing people dying as a result of the introduction of a pandemic and how that pandemic was handled and how it is being treated, in inverted commas, with a vaccination program. Now, both speakers mentioned something which I think is very important. Alex talked about they want to control our minds, said they want, quote, civilized control over politically backward people. And that latter quote absolutely shows the arrogance of these individuals, these gangsters, because they believe that any opinion they hold is the correct opinion, the correct value, and anybody who challenges them is a lesser being who I would suggest ultimately they want to remove from their field of operations. And what does that mean? Ultimately, they would like these people to go away and die. So let's just remind ourselves and bridge across to the fact that Alex said that this is a battle for our minds, and this is very true at the moment. Rainer, when I gave you my initial thoughts on what was happening, I said we need to be aware that alongside the COVID-19 pandemic and the subsequent vaccination program, we need to be aware that there is a battle for our minds by an applied political psychological attack. So if I bridge the gap, I happen to have a couple of papers with me. The first one is entitled Mental Health. The subtitle is Strategic Planning for Mental Health. It was by a certain Gail Reese. And interestingly enough, the date on this paper that I hold is October 1940. So in the middle of the Second World War, or the start of the Second World War, I should say, we had a group of people who were later to become very powerful within the World Health and World Health Organization system, discussing how they were going to implement what they called mental hygiene in the new society. And they didn't mess around, because they said that in doing it, they were going to infiltrate social organizations. They were going to attack the professions. They were going to infiltrate social activities and professional societies, and that they were going to unleash a long-term plan of propaganda. And I'm going to reinforce that 1940 paper by saying very quickly, I have another one in my hands, which I'm, of course, happy to share as evidence. It's entitled Psychiatry. It's part of the Journal of the Biology and Pathology of Interpersonal Relations. It's dated February 1946, and it's talking about the re-establishment of the peacetime society, and the author is a certain G.B. Chisholm. And if people research that name, they'll find another figure who's deeply connected with the sort of societies that Matt has very concisely put in front of us. Why should we pay attention to this second? Because it's talking about the use of the psychiatric system in order to implement, yes, this program of mental hygiene. And if our jury wishes to know what mental hygiene means, it essentially means that you're not fit to be a human being unless you adopt the views and values and opinions of the gangsters that we've already determined have a plan for domination. So I'm going to say that when I began to research what was happening in UK from a point of view of crime and fraud, threats and bullying at local level, I quickly established, to my astonishment, that there was a charity, it was called Common Purpose, that was acting in a very political way in creating future leaders. And I was fascinated that these people were installing themselves in UK cities and effectively manipulating, taking control, you could say, of politics within those cities. So here was a group of people recruiting people they considered to be future leaders, starting to take over the control of cities within UK. Well, if I broaden that out, within a few years, that organization was operating overseas in countries like Germany, Holland, India, Australia, where they were recruiting people in those countries in order to bring them within an agenda of change agents to change the way we think and conduct our business in society. And if we say, where did this organization come from? Well, it was started in about 1985 as a result of one particular lady, the chief executive at the time, Julia Middleton, coming back from, I believe, Chicago, but certainly America, saying she'd learned some amazing things about how to change society. And the interesting point was that a large sum of money was collected from a number of banks. And remember, the monetary power has been central to the first two speakers' dialogue. But Common Purpose was able to get going with funding from major banks that were never disclosed. However, I can say with great confidence that Deutsche Bank was one of the key banks working with that organization. Now, why have I brought in Common Purpose? Well, Common Purpose was a key example of an organization you could track, you could see the documents, you could see the people, and you could see that it was unleashing a plan to change our society without the average member of the public understanding this. So where do we need to come to now? I think really we need to just do a little recap on what Alex mentioned, because I'd like to bring you back to the Mindspace document, which is my slide number one, if we can bring this up on screen. And this document produced by the British Cabinet Office was a document where they had been working with psychologists for a long time to learn how to change the way that people thought and behaved without people understanding this was happening. That's not an opinion by me, because if we go to the second slide, hopefully it's coming up on screen, if you read the text on screen, it says that the government, the British government, would be able to, the way people thought, the way they believed, their behavior, and people would not necessarily recognize that this had happened. It would be subconscious. Their behavior, their thoughts would have changed, but they would not know. But the document further qualifies it by saying that if people did realize how their behavior had changed, they would not necessarily know how it had been done. Now, let me connect that more or less right up to date with the COVID-19 pandemic, because if we bring slide three onto your screen, these are the minutes of the Spybee, as it's called. It's part of the British government's wise scientists group, SAGE, who were commenting on how we should be, quote, fighting COVID. But Spybee was a team of specialists, including behavioral specialists, who were going to use applied psychology to get people to adhere to the British government's policy on COVID-19. And what I draw people's attention to are really two paragraphs. One is at the bottom of the left-hand page where it says the perceived level of personal threats sorry, the perceived level of personal threat needs to be increased amongst complacent using the hard-hitting emotional messaging. So here was a government team advocating the use of applied psychology in order to make people fearful. And I would say that it's no wonder that we now have trained psychologists and psychiatrists pointing out the danger of making people fearful, particularly if you use techniques which mean they have no way of grounding where that fear has come from. This is not my opinion. I'm quoting directly from the British government's own document. And what is equally concerning is a later paragraph, paragraph 7, talks about coercion, in which it says consideration should be given to the use of social disapproval, but with a strong caveat around unwanted negative consequences. What they're talking about is using people to police each other, people to say, I'm wearing a mask, you're not wearing a mask, you're a bad person, get out of my way. But the caveat that they introduced to this was because they recognized that this psychological technology could unleash violence in communities. Now, I have taken in one quick step discussion about how you can dominate people into an area where we are seeing the British government in 2010, which is the original document, but also through to the present day, boasting that it could use applied psychology to change the way people thought and the way people behave. What did they do with that psychology? That psychology was actually was sold initially to America and Australia. Look at what is happening in Australia in relation to COVID lockdown at the moment. But ultimately, the technologies, as Debbie will indicate in a few moments, was actually sold off worldwide. So now we have world governments able to use this applied behavioral psychology to change people's views, values, behavior, and they simply do not know this has been unleashed on them. And just to reinforce this point, if I can bring up on screen slide 4, this is a document which I've only found very recently, but it's entitled Behavioral Insights Applied to Policy, Germany, Country Overview. This is an EU document which is effectively boasting of exactly the same thing, how applied behavioral psychology can be used to change community, public, political opinion. And it's giving a whole list of German organizations, which I'm sure will be, much more significant to the panel than to me, but a lot of them are universities and research organizations. This document is effectively simple proof that these political psychology techniques have certainly been spread throughout Europe. So I'm going to suggest it's very clear that we have a team of gangsters in power, whether we're talking UK or the European Union or the US. And in the hands of these gangsters, we have got a very dangerous weapon of applied behavioral psychology. Let me now jump to the subject of COVID-19 and in particular vaccine effects. In the United Kingdom, we have the Medicine and Health Products Regulatory Organization, the MHRA. That organization supposedly is tasked keeping the public safe with regard to pharmaceutical products and vaccines. And as part of the vaccination program in UK, they've been collecting data on vaccine adverse reactions, which they call the yellow card system. And to date, if I can just find the figures, because I noted them down, to date, their own statistics say that there have been nearly 1.5 million adverse effects from vaccines, and there have been close to 2,000 deaths, with a caveat they have made themselves to say that they believe it likely that only 10% of the vaccine adverse effects that have actually occurred have indeed been logged. So, of course, that takes the number of deaths from 2,000 to 20,000. And what is interesting when you do this is we're now starting to see vaccine deaths outstrip the dangers of COVID-19. But we have to remember that the MHRA as a government department is perfectly prepared to use the same skills in applied psychology that the British government has boasted they can use to mislead the public and change their behavior. So when we approach the MHRA and say to them, we ask them a simple question, where is your quantitative risk assessment to show that the vaccine adverse reactions are not a result of the vaccinations themselves, the MHRA stalls, fails to answer, produces very confusing replies. But the nub of it is that this key organization, the MHRA, has not conducted a quantitative risk assessment into the adverse effects of vaccinations. And I'm going to put it to the panel. We're effectively in a court. That the MHRA, who holds the duty of protecting the public from dangerous pharmaceutical products, knows that people are dying as a result of the vaccination campaign. And I'm going to add that the British government certainly knows that, but is prepared to use psychology in every single verbal, written, and media response around the dangers of the COVID and the vaccine policy. Now, just before I hand over to Debbie to get into some of the way that the system works, I just wanted to point out that, of course, the whole of the control of COVID-19 policy and the so-called health care policy around COVID-19 and vaccinations has been carried out by the British Cabinet Office, who have an embedded applied behavioral psychology team with them. So we know what they're capable of. They're boasting of it in their own document. And ultimately, we're seeing the real evidence of people suffering and dying. But I'd like to just hand over to Debbie, because if we follow this trail on, we come to how the system works in UK, at least, where we're seeing a form of medical fascism between government and the global pharmaceutical industry working alongside universities and charities within what has been named the Golden Triangle in UK. So if I could just hand over to Debbie just to take the last 15 minutes.
Thank you, Brian. Good evening, everyone. My name's Debbie Evans. I'm a retired state registered nurse. I trained at the Royal Free Hospital in London, where coincidentally, they're now nursing Lassa fever as of today in the UK. And I did postgraduate training at St. Bartholomew's Hospital in the City of London. And I was a government advisor at the Department of Health for the UK government for 5 years. And I'm a medical researcher. And Brian led us very, very nicely there into what we call in the UK Locke's Bridge Triangle, or the Golden University, the Golden University Triangle. And there is a screenshot of a map of the UK, if you can put it up, just to show the locations of Oxford, Cambridge and London in the triangle. I don't know if you're able to see it or not. You can see it. Fabulous. Cambridge is the highest digital tech centre in the UK. It's ranked 12th in the European Digital Index, and it's actually known as Silicon Fen. It's got a huge biomedical campus on site. There is a screenshot of the biomedical campus, which will tell you what is on the biomedical campus. And what's on it, amongst other things, is Papworth Hospital, which has been moved to the biomedical campus, which specializes in heart and lung. We've also got Adam Brooks Hospital, which specializes in donated organs and transplants. We've also been told by Boris Johnson, our Prime Minister, that there will be a cancer research hospital being erected there as well at a huge cost, despite the fact that cancer rates in the UK have been falling. We're to have a cancer research hospital. Also on that campus is the Medical Research Council, Cancer Research UK, which I'll come back to in a minute, the Anne McLaren Regenerative Laboratory, and the NHS Blood Transfusion Centre. So that's, and amongst other things, that's at Cambridge, and AstraZeneca's headquarters, with GlaxoSmithKline too. What's interesting about Cambridge is that Cancer Research UK, which is meant to be a charity, but would appear not to be a charity at all, Professor Robert West, is a consultant for Cancer Research UK, and he's also on the SPY-B team, the behaviour team that Brian was just talking about with regards to SAGE. Professor Robert West's wife, Professor Susan Mickey, is the head of the Behavioural Insights team at the Cabinet Office. She's a lifelong communist, and has designed the Behaviour Change Wheel and has rolled that out into many countries. The Behavioural Insights team appear to be global now. With regards to going back to the Golden Triangle in Oxford, we've got one of the most dynamic digital tech economies in the UK, with a big campus there, with Oxford Nanopore, very, very high tech biomedical campus. We've also got Milton Keynes is mentioned in this Golden Triangle because it's the UK's first smart city, using sensors, which I'll come on to, and big tech innovation. So going down into London, there is another slide, Med City, if you can see that, which is a knowledge economy. It's meant to be the digital capital of Europe, and it's been named by Tech Nation, attracting $2.1 billion worth of investments. So the Golden Triangle within the UK is where all the attention seems to be focused on. And the UK government has actually just announced it's investing $5.5 billion into infrastructure around the Golden Triangle, which is sometimes known as the Loxbridge Triangle. And the brain curve, I think it's known as well. So when we look at the Golden Triangle and the universities that are involved, we can see that the Golden Universities, Oxford and Cambridge, have also got attached to them the Russell Group, which are 24 universities within the Russell Group that work very closely alongside the Golden Triangle universities and receive a lot of funding. Where I'm seeing, what I'm seeing really is two things coming up ahead. One is that the MHRA in the UK would like to become the global regulator. On their board sits Raj Long, who's the deputy director for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. She specializes in safety and pharmacovigilance, and also the chief scientist for Microsoft. So we see huge conflicts of interest there. We also see some conflicts of interest with regards to the British government, to ministers, and some of the ministers' interests are into the big four audit companies, KPMG and Microsoft also, Deloitte, AstraZeneca, Goldman Sachs, and the European Investment Bank. So a lot of our ministers have conflicts of interest within those within those areas. What we can see coming up is that Deloitte, in particular, I just focus in on Deloitte for a minute, because Deloitte, Ernst Young, KPMG, and PricewaterhouseCoopers take up 67% of global accounting. All four are based in London, Deloitte have been central to the test and trace. Lord Bethel, who has now resigned, had a company that was purely for lobbying on behalf of Deloitte for bids. And it's very concerning to see that when you see all of these people intertwined with one another, what could be coming up in the future. And I just want to go back very quickly to how charities seem to be involved in this as well as government organizations and what I would call in fact a quango. Cancer UK, I can just find my notes. I'm so sorry, I've got a book of notes to try and be very quick because I realize we haven't got very much time. Cancer UK is funded by many pharmaceutical companies. In fact, I would say it's the research and development center actually for pharmaceutical companies, AstraZeneca, GlaxoSmithKline, Bill and Melinda Gates. But also advising cancer research is Professor Robert West, who's Professor Susan Mickey's husband, a behavioral insights team funded by Pfizer and funded by Cancer Research UK, who are also right in the middle of the Cambridge Biomedical Campus. As well as that, with regards to the UK government, they published a vaccine hesitancy guidance with interventions on the 27th of September 2019, way before Wuhan was even mentioned. They are also looking at, and I'm very concerned with regards to antimicrobial resistance. The UK government has its own UK envoy, Dame Sally Davis, who used to be our chief medical officer, who is the chief envoy, the UK envoy for antimicrobial resistance. And what I'm seeing coming down the line is we appear to see people being tested for HIV, but according to Forbes, the next pandemic would be expected to be tuberculosis. I know that Professor Montagnier, I'd like to send my sincere condolences to his family and all those that know him, by the way. Extremely, extremely sad that he passed recently. But Professor Montagnier was mentioning to one of his colleagues with regards to the BCG vaccine, and it would appear that Professor Chris Whitty, our chief medical officer, was giving a presentation at Gresham House three nights ago, and was linking also tuberculosis and HIV. And the World Health Organization is very keen on eradicating antimicrobial resistance. And TB, we've had BCG for TB for a long, long time. And it's thought that the TB levels are rising exponentially, including here in the UK. And we're now seeing new vaccines being developed for TB and new testing facilities for TB. So I'm looking down the pipeline and seeing a reference to tuberculosis. I'm also looking at cancer and dementia because that would appear to be on the rise as well. In particular, with regards to cancer, obviously we don't know the long-term side effects of the vaccine. Or whether it could be carcinogenic, but certainly one of the antivirals that they're using here in the UK and the UK alone, molnupiravir, would appear to be carcinogenic, teratogenic and mutagenic. We're using it here as on a clinical trial with Panoramic. So patients that are receiving it are immediately hooked up onto the trial. I'm also seeing all of these things that we are now seeing unwrap now. I don't know if you're aware of SPARS pandemic 2025 to 2028, which was a futuristic scenario. I think Brian could probably show up a copy of it. I think he's got one handy. There it is. SPARS pandemic 2025 to 2028, which was a futuristic scenario from the Johns Hopkins Center on what would happen if a coronavirus infected the world, basically. And it takes you on a month-to-month basis. So what you could expect from the media, what you can expect from pharmaceutical companies, what you can expect from governments with regards to lockdowns, with regards to testing, with regards to antibiotics, and also antibiotic resistance. So antimicrobial resistance is a really, really big subject, one that pretty much everybody's looking at. The World Bank, the World Economic Forum, the UK government, pretty much every government in the world is looking at antimicrobial resistance. So I'm looking at thinking, well, maybe possibly we could be looking at superbugs in the future. With regards to going back, sorry to go back to the big four again, but it would seem that we also have conflicts of interest with regards to those. The CEO of Deloitte has now left. Deloitte retired, but is now on the board of Pfizer. We also had the UK government, Hansard, I think I've actually got the Hansard numbers in May 2014. There was to be a merger between Pfizer and AstraZeneca, but the UK government were very undecided about it. So there is a reference in Hansard in volume 753. It was debated on the 6th of May 2014, and again in column 161 on the 7th of May 2014, with the past Secretary of State Matt Hancock talking. So our British government are in it up to their necks, I believe, with regards to pharmaceuticals. We seem to be heading for global life science superpower since we've left Brexit. Most of the agenda is with regards to life sciences and how we can be the global life science partner. Cancer Research UK and the Francis Crick organization work together, and they purely are funded pretty much by public donations, but also by big pharma. There's also mainstream media adverts going out for a company called Omaze, O-M-A-Z-E, and it's a competition line where you can win a £3 million house, but donations and proceeds go to Cancer UK, Cancer Research UK. Some of the funders of Cancer Research UK, which are based on the Cambridge Biomedical Campus, are the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Google, the World Economic Forum, Imperial College, Cambridge, UKRI, Bank of England, AstraZeneca, Crick Institute, CQC, and the BBC. So they are very, very heavily funded, and I don't think the public know this when they're jumping out of aeroplanes trying to raise money for cancer research. Professor Whitty and all of our experts tell us that cancer rates are falling. However, we appear to be testing healthy people in the UK for cancer using Bill Gates' company, Grail, which was a joint venture with Jeff Bezos. It's now been contracted to work within the National Health Service in order to genome sequence, using it by genome sequencing for cancer. We're testing healthy people. And I would ask why we're testing healthy people. The reason that the government are giving is that the cost, the burden and the cost of cancer and aging and dementia is so high that we need rapid acceleration of diagnosis, rapid acceleration of treatment. So basically, safety goes pretty much through the window, as in the vaccine development, which is now going to be under Bill and Melinda Gates and Patrick Balance's 100-day mission. So any other pandemic that could be called, you can guarantee that you'll have a vaccine within 100 days, according to the 100-day mission. I don't know if anybody wants to ask any questions. I'm very aware of time and that you're running over, so I don't want to take up too much of the floor.
I would like to ask questions of each of you, please, pertaining to the psychological manipulation that's been going on. I'm Anna Garner from New Mexico, the United States. And Ms. Evans, you mentioned that you had been a government advisor to the Department of Health, and this is very pertinent here because I feel that this has been going on in the United States extensively. As an advisor to the Public Health Department, have you been aware that they use the behavioral psychological techniques that Mr. Garish discussed as a way of enforcing their agenda of coercion and social isolation, coercion of people undergoing experimental medical interventions? Have you noticed that that is part of their operating modus operandi, shall we say?
When I was an advisor at the Department of Health, what was becoming blatantly obvious was that any advisor was really there as a tokenistic approach, and that we weren't actually being listened to. Many of us were ignored. I wouldn't say that we were coerced. I certainly don't feel as though I was coerced into saying or doing anything. I'm pretty strong, so I did challenge. In fact, probably my challenging people was causing more of an upset because I wasn't compliant. But it was purely tokenistic. But as coercion, yes, I could see huge problems within the civil service, many personal problems, many bullying. I was got very close to one of the senior civil servants on our particular board that was run by the then Norman Lamb, who was the Secretary of State. And there was a huge amount of bullying. There was a huge amount of competition within the civil service. We did notice that. But as an advisor, I wasn't part of the civil service, so it was just my observations.
And not to interrupt you or anything, but what I was referring to was the psychological techniques of basically coercing the people as opposed to people who were involved in the advising, but rather the public.
Could I help here?
Yes.
Can I respond? As part of research that the UK Column did, we did through the UK Column, one of the areas that we were very interested in was training within our National Health Service by this charity, selecting future leaders. So this was common purpose. So we saw manipulation of people and their values by this particular organization. And it morphed into a specific sector of the NHS called NHS leaders. And these supposedly were fast-tracked people who were going to lead the NHS into even better healthcare. But what we see is that as these leaders with their newly acquired values were unleashed, the management style in the NHS became increasingly domineering and bullying, and the ideas became less and less about the care and treatment of people who were ill or injured, and it became much more about the importance of profits and money within the NHS. And I'm going to say it was apparent that the psychology of people was being manipulated. We have up on the UK Column website an article which is entitled Towards a Million Change Agents. And that was not our title. That was the title of a paper written by an NHS common purpose trained individual who said that the NHS, in order to reach, my words, a future utopia, was going to need a million change agents. And what do they mean by that? People who were going to disrupt the performance of the NHS in order to get it to transition, to transform into what was supposedly to be a world-class health provision. So I can give that to you as one specific example where we were looking at how the management and leadership inside the NHS had changed. But I'll give you a very simple one about applied psychology in the NHS during the COVID crisis, because mantras were introduced. Instead of medical decisions, nurses and doctors started to follow mantras. And one of the ones that we were told out by a fully qualified, a highly qualified doctor in the last few days is relatives of somebody who'd suffered, was that the mantra was COVID unvaccinated death pathway. COVID unvaccinated death pathway. And that is simply, if the person was deemed or labeled as having COVID, if it was determined they were unvaccinated, the only result of their healthcare treatment was the death pathway. And there is no question that these particularly three-word mantras that we've seen used by the government in particular have been driven through the NHS to the extent that qualified doctors have said to us they've been amazed when they cannot discuss genuine government figures on, for example, vaccine adverse reactions, because the person simply turns away or refuses to talk to them or becomes very aggressive. And the psychologist support that we're able to call on at the moment is witnessing is cognitive dissonance in individuals, the result of their mental values being reframed. So I could talk for a long time on this, but I'm going to say, yes, we are certainly seeing that there is the application of applied psychology in many areas in the NHS, and its overall effect is a degradation of healthcare treatment to the extent people are being killed when they could have survived quite happily had they been given the right treatment.
Yes. Thank you for that clarification. And I had a follow-up question for you as well, Mr. Gerrish. And that was, this psychological operation, by definition, seems to be very subtle and below most people's level of awareness that they are being manipulated. If that's the case, do you have any opinion about how those people can be reached in a way that can wake them up? I hear about the psychological dissonance and that sort of thing, the cognitive dissonance. Is there a way in which these people can be encouraged to see what's really happening, that they are being manipulated this way?
Right. That of course, is a very important question. And the response, and I qualify myself here because I'm not professionally trained in psychology, but as a result of my work and investigation over mayors and advice I've received from fully qualified people, I'm going to give this as personal comment, but I believe it to be very accurate. If you apply a form of hypnosis to people, the effect on a target audience generally forms a bell curve. You will find some people can be completely hypnotized. Stage hypnosis demonstrate this when people will go and do things they won't normally do in front of an audience because they're in a trance-like state. But if we use more forms of manipulation, the effect on the target audience is a bell curve. So some people are very consumed with the message that's been put across, but it drops off either side to some people who are totally. And the indications to us to date, and this is also supported by qualified psychologists, is that in the first instance, we need to concentrate on the people who are clearly not affected in order to spread the warning message to what's happening. We clearly need to be targeting the professions of psychology and psychiatry to say this is the abuse of those particular professions, particularly clinical psychology and psychiatry, which we can say has got a health beneficiary health result. And also to realize that people who have been subjected to this form of reframing or mind manipulation are victims, and therefore they need to be treated in a very gentle and reassuring way, because if we come at them in a very blunt way, black and white way, to try and make them see the truth, the result is that either they're going to become very hostile with cognitive dissonance, or possibly they're going to become unwell mentally as a result of the immense assault on their value system. And can I just say to you, it is very significant that in all the documentation about the British government's use of applied psychology, get its political agenda enacted, there is absolutely no assessment as to what the adverse effects of such psychology may be on people who perhaps have underlying mental health issues, anxiety or depression, and indeed where people have got undiagnosed mental health conditions, so they're not even aware that they've got a problem. Somebody is using this psychology on them, you can do immense damage. And I believe it is no coincidence that the official statistics in UK now show that the lockdown policy has caused a huge surge in suicides and mental illness, particularly amongst people, tragically, amongst young people. But again, we can demonstrate that the UK government is hiding or manipulating the data sets that show this, or they're using applied psychology in the way they present those data sets to the public in order to further mislead the public. This is the nature of the beast. Once you understand that you have what I'm going to call a criminal political system that has the ability to use applied psychology to change the way the public thinks, we've got a very, very dangerous weapon in the hands of these elitists. And this is easily evidenced. I've put up a key document where the spy beam was boasting that we need to make people more fearful, more anxious. And there are many other documents. And I've also demonstrated for the benefit of the Germans amongst the audience and on the team that applied behavioral psychology has now been let loose within Germany, certainly within France, because one of Sarkozy's personal teams, a gentleman called Oliver Willier, had meetings in UK facilitated by the Franco-British Council in 2010 to discuss how French neurological and psychological experts were going to work with the British in order to develop these applied psychological techniques. The evidence trail is there. It's when you know what you're looking for, it's obvious. But my goodness, this is the most dangerous thing I believe we have ever seen. If you have propaganda and political manipulation within Nazi Germany, in many ways it could be seen, the parades, the banners, the lights, the rhetoric, the posters. But what we've got unleashed on us now is a subliminal attack on our minds. And until we bring the full light to this, it's going to be very, very difficult for us to take the lid off what these people are doing through their COVID and vaccination attack on people. Each of the pharmaceutical companies has access to this psychological weapon. Each of the legal companies, I've forgotten, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Debbie, audit. Help me out. What do we call these companies? Auditing companies.
The big four.
Yeah. So everywhere we see charities, industry, public bodies working with the British government, we know that the use of the psychology is spread between them. So we've got to start talking about this in a very big way, and we've got to be, first of all, dealing with the people who are unaffected. They realize something's wrong, but they don't know what it is. And then the public, equally, they could be very intelligent and highly qualified professionals. And I'll just leave you to think about a well-qualified psychologist said to me, that's hearsay, but I'm going to repeat it, said to me, Brian, the thing to remember is that people who are intelligent and have highly questioning minds can be more susceptible to the use of hypnosis, reframing, applied psychology than somebody who is less intelligent and has less of an inquiring mind. So it is very wrong if anybody is thinking, well, I'm a bright person, I'm intelligent, I'm highly qualified, this would affect me. On the contrary, you may be more vulnerable.
And could I, Brian, just, perhaps,
just add there that the cascade of information, the NHS professionals that I'm speaking to and all of them that I'm speaking to are completely confused. They're having a cascade of information every single day. Things are changing. They don't know what, I mean, I am seeing NHS professionals doing things that would be completely alien to them. I'm giving respiratorial depressants to respiratory patients. It's just alien to what we have been taught. So people are frightened. And I would echo what Brian said. You know, people, when they are starting to wake up, they're scared. They don't know what's happening. They need us to reassure them, because at the moment, the agenda is confusion, chaos, and crisis. And you know, going back to what Brian just said just now about Deloitte and about the Big Four, I mean, for anybody that doesn't know, Deloitte are, they've written papers on the future of the City of London, the clinical trials, their past CEO is now a board member of Pfizer, they're involved in the NHS, they're involved in corporate intelligence, as are the other three. And clearly, when Brian was mentioning SPARS pandemic, that goes hand in hand with Operation Claydex and Crimson Contagion. Now, Claydex was held by the Johns Hopkins University in 2018, I think, simulating 900 million deaths. And Crimson Contagion, another exercise as well, that went on during the Trump reign, for a response to a pandemic, an ongoing pandemic of flu. So all of this has been well documented, and well documented in the patent for the COVID testing by the Rothschilds, which again, everything that we can see within that patent in the main paper, we're seeing being rolled out now, including biosensors. You know, many people have spoken about RFID chips, but not many people are speaking about the advent of biosensors and how biosensors don't need the internet. You can have them in your clothes, on the sole of your shoes. They can be in your food. And biosensors seem to be the way things are going, to the point that there is a biosensor institute here in the UK, in Bristol, and the MHRA have actually approved one of the biosensors, because you'll have people will have biosensors in their cars, on their laptops, and their biometric data will be fed back, so that all of your biometric, are you fit to drive the train? Are you fit to drive a coach? Are you fit to do anything? Your biometric data will be stored, and it will be, it's happening now.
So if I put a little summary on that, what we are seeing is a political system integrated with global commercial companies, pharmaceutical companies, unleashing an agenda which has been to test vaccines on a population without any care for the damage and the dying. Where are they going? They're going for manipulation of our genes. There's no question of this. And Britain, all the data we're seeing at the moment is that it is UK that says it is going to take the world lead in putting this agenda together. the UK, and I'll qualify that and say I believe this would ultimately be driven by the City of London. But all of the UK documents say we will take the world lead. And this is the same UK unleashed this malicious applied psychology to change the way our cognitive processes work. It's a very, very dangerous combination.
And just to perhaps add my final point, Alex, is that the unique selling point for the United Kingdom is the National Health Service. There is no way to opt out of it. From the moment that you're conceived and you've had the pregnant mum's had a scan, there's data on that particular human being until the day we die. There's no way of opting out of the NHS. So NHS data is very, very precious, and it's completely unique to the rest of the world.
And it's a massive database. Yeah.
If we could succinctly illustrate that with the one slide I didn't show, I think it aptly summarises what Brian and Debbie have just said, if Paul can find it within a few seconds. It's a slide that UK Column has used quite a lot, of an organogram of the British government's ruling agency, the Cabinet Office, with a new group, since in the decade that I left British intelligence, called the National Security Council. Like the American example from the FDR era, it's not original and not constitutional. And all of the bodies that fall off away from the Cabinet Office under its control on that organogram are to do with controlling the agenda, and to answer the question that was asked here, to stop us from being able to show more people what the paradigm is, to stop them from being afraid by the applied psychology that is being got to them. The military is involved. There's a 77 signals, 77th regiment, a 13 signals brigade. There are entirely new British government security agencies, the so-called Health Security Agency, the Joint Biosecurity Centre, all of these new since my time. And the buck stops with this Cabinet Office. And all the good studies of the Cabinet Office will show you that the leading committees there have a direct line to the City of London. They represent elite corporate will. There is no democratic control, and even the personal crown, the monarch, is not involved. So I don't know whether that was shown on screen a moment ago or not, but people can also easily find it as one of the main UK column graphics, Cabinet Office Censorship Network, I believe we call it in one version.
So ultimately what we're dealing with is a British system of psychiatric manipulation, which has been sold worldwide, more or less. We have the City of London, again, aiming for world control. Is that why the common purpose people are creating their own future leaders? Is that a special position apart from the Young Global Leaders program?
Well, as with these things, the attack comes in from parallel direction. So I would strongly suggest that many people with Upper's network will have no idea of what the wider objective is. They are recruited. In the time I was really researching in detail, somebody would be recruited locally and asked to join. It wasn't as if people were going to Common Purpose to join. Common Purpose sought out the people they wanted, and the agenda was clearly to train that future leader to work with other Common Purpose future leaders. And this is why it's so significant when you see Common Purpose now operating, for example, very strongly in India. And former Prime Minister David Cameron was part of the team promoting Common Purpose in India. So Common Purpose is one of the routes by which people are being recruited and reframed. The World Economic Forum Young Global Leaders would be another route via which probably more powerful people are recruited, reframed, to bring them in line with what their new role is. So Common Purpose is particularly operating at low-level public level in the first instance. But as time went on from 1985, it was clear to see that they got involved with the corporate, the big global corporates, much more strongly, and then from there they've gone to their world status. But what are we doing? We're selecting people. Their egos are being stroked because somebody's suggesting they're going to become a very important future leader. World Economic Forum calls them global leaders. And then these people are being put together in order to change the world. That is the objective.